A thing that looks like a police box standing in a junkyard. It can move anywhere.
Haven, concentrate on Sin. Give priority to the detectors and the navigation systems.
There is a corridor. And the corridor is time. It surrounds all things.
On display, I eventually had to go down to the cellar. That's the display department. With a torch. The lights are probably gone. So had the stairs.
Yours is number 6.
I am not a number. I am a person.
Welcome to British Invaders, episode 147. This is the podcast all about British science fiction television, and today we are talking about The Invisible Man. This is Brian from Canada.
And this is Eamon from England. Hello.
This was a BBC miniseries from 1984 that ran 6 30-minute episodes, and it was an adaptation of the H.G. Wells novel, The Invisible Man.
That's right, and it was a BBC classic serial strand, so a sort of one in a series of classic adaptations, and quite faithful to the source material, quite faithful to H.G. Wells's novel, and perhaps slightly more so than other adaptations we've talked about, Brian.
Yes, we have done a British Invaders discussion about The Invisible Man, but that was about the late 1950s ITV series. We talked about it in episode 73 and 74, and that was more based on the character and not based on the novel itself. And even then, it was loosely based on the character. So it was an interesting show for its time. But this show from the 1980s is a very different type of show than that. And it is classic and one of the classic archetypes of horror, and especially, I think, of science fiction. So it's good to be touching on that in this adaptation.
Absolutely. I love to get to these 19th century sort of horror and science fiction archetypes. I've mentioned it before when we've considered things like Frankenstein, and here we are with The Invisible Man, and The Invisible Man, the proper one, I think, the original one here.
Yes, that's more along the lines we're talking about, is really looking at an adaptation of this novel.
Okay, so the setup, a stranger appears in the small village of Ipin, takes a room at the local inn, and he immediately rouses the suspicions of the locals. And you know what he looks like almost without me having to describe him. He has a bandaged head, dark goggle-like glasses, a hat, a cape. He is the very sort of mysterious figure that he sort of like appears as right from the start. And straight away, he's met with suspicion.
Yes, absolutely. And very much the image that was described by H.G. Wells and what we've seen in many adaptations over the years. And he accepts some deliveries that were mailed to him that he had arranged to send him ahead of time. So his room at this inn is soon filled with bottles with strange chemicals and all these pieces of equipment that are really quite unusual for the time. And of course, no one has seen him except for this bandaged appearance. And there is all this speculation about what his injuries might be by the locals in this sort of very isolated, rural-type little village.
That's right, yes. They assume he must have been horribly injured to be covered in bandages. And yes, it's a strange little sort of village. It's very remote. We should say that it is set at the time of the novel's publication, so this is the late 19th century. And they are very sort of, bothered by his appearance and by the strange goings-on in his room.
Yes, that's right. So strange equipment and things. We're talking about things like optical microscopes and lenses and hand tools and different things. They're of that era, but there are things that would be quite refined pieces of equipment for that time. the characters. The central character is Griffin, the Invisible Man himself, played by Pip Donaghy. And of course, we see this appearance with the bandages, the dark glasses, the gloves, the heavy coat, and the hat and everything. And we learn that he is a scientist who has been working on the mysteries of optical density of materials and how optical densities can be changed and modified and manipulated.
That's right. Yes, he is interested in all that, and that's what he seems to be working on. And as well as the sort of various locals who greeted his arrival with suspicion, we get two more sort of senior figures in the village who get involved. The first is the local doctor, Dr. Edward Cuss, played by Gerald James, who is called out by the innkeeper to treat Griffin after there is an incident at the inn. And then we have the vicar, the Reverend Edward Bunting, played by an actor with a long sort of genre history, Michael Sheard, who's been in Doctor Who, Blake 7, Beasts, Tomorrow People, and of course was in one of the Star Wars movies, the second one, I believe. And together with the GP, the doctor, the vicar, and he sort of start to discuss the strange events that are happening in Ipin, which seem to have started since the arrival of the mysterious stranger. And it was nice to see them, particularly nice to see Michael Sheard in this.
Yes, absolutely. You get the sense that it is the doctor and the vicar who represent the educated people and the people who have a greater sense of authority in this little village at that time. We also have Thomas Marvel, played by Frank Middlemass, who was basically a tramp, someone living outdoors and in and around, and he gets drawn into the Invisible Man's schemes. You know, the Invisible Man needs a helper, so he basically says, you know, okay, you're gonna help me out. And Marvel doesn't have all that much choice in the matter and ends up going along with it.
And then we have one more character that we'll mention here, Dr. Samuel Kemp, who will turn up in the second half of the story, played by the actor David Gwillem. Kemp is a scientist and a former colleague of Griffin's, and it's to Kemp that Griffin will start to explain a little bit of his history and mystery, and maybe reveal some of the secrets. So we'll get some exposition later on in the story.
Yes, absolutely. And we get the questions of, is Kemp really an ally for Griffin, the Invisible Man, or is he someone who will turn against him? And of course, questions of morality of different types come up. So there's definitely some interesting things in the relationship there. Now, as the plot goes on, while receiving a delivery of some equipment at the inn, Griffin is bitten by a dog. And it's then, of course, that the landlord summons the local doctor to look at Griffin, because he's just been quite badly bitten by this dog who just sort of grabbed on and would not let go.
That's right. And that's when we get one of the first glimpses of what lies beneath the mysterious stranger's sort of clothes and bandages, because when the dog bites his leg or rips his trouser leg, one of the villagers glimpses blackness below the trouser leg of Griffin. And of course, this contrasts with the pink that we see of the tip of his nose poking out through his bandages, the only part of his flesh we can see. And of course, this puzzles the villagers as to what is the colour of Griffin's skin and what's going on behind that trouser leg and those bandages. And of course, as you say, we've got the local doctor being summoned.
Yes, Dr. Cuss arrives and insists at taking a look at Griffin, and Griffin does not deal well with this, and Griffin ends up basically toying with this local doctor. The doctor sees Griffin with one of his gloves taken off and sees that his sleeve appears to be empty but is still moving around. And of course, Griffin, you know, pinches him on the nose, and, you know, he gets this odd, you know, what's going on there, and starts to get some idea that this strange invisibility phenomenon is happening there.
Yeah, absolutely. It's you know, a bit of a mystery for the doctor, because he can't figure out what's going on and how on earth this invisible hand pinched him on the nose. And it's all, you know, it's all a bit strange. And of course, Griffin himself is a rather unpleasant character. He's very sort of short-tempered and deals with people very shortly. So he's not a popular character locally.
That's right. And he is continuing with his own research, and he has his notebooks there, and he wants greater control of this to be able to become visible again and then switch back and forth as he sees fit and this sort of thing.
And he's experimenting on himself, so that results in strange noises and in particular cries and screams coming from his room, and that particularly alarms all the regulars and the innkeeper and his wife at the inn. And so basically suspicion is mounting. They really do not like this mysterious stranger. They don't like having Griffin there. And of course, his character doesn't help either.
Yes, that's right. And the innkeeper was sort of welcoming to him, because Griffin came in and paid by the week and was able to pay quite well for this space that he was taking at the inn. But eventually he starts to fall behind in his rent, and they start asking, you know, for him to pay up already. And he doesn't seem to have the money. But then there is a strange burglary, a strange robbery at the vicarage, at the vicar's home, in fact. It's clear to us exactly what's happening, that the invisible man is behind it. But to the other characters, it looks very strange indeed.
Yes, absolutely. And as you can gather from this production, as we go along, it's fairly clear to us that this is, you know, what the Invisible Man is doing, and which actions are caused by the Invisible Man. But of course, to the characters in the village, they have no idea what's going on and cannot explain the mysteries and the burglaries and so on.
That's right.
A bit gloomy in here, isn't it? Should we get a bit more light?
No! Leave the lamp where it is, please.
Just as you like, sir. I thought you might like to have a bit more light to see by, that's all.
My eyes are very weak. I'm sometimes obliged to shut myself up in the dark for hours. A strong light is a source of excruciating pain to me.
I'm sorry.
I need this parlour for my own private use.
It's got private written on the door, sir. No one's going to disturb you in here.
Nevertheless, I do not wish to be disturbed by anybody.
Well, I'm sure that can be arranged. Good night, sir.
Night.
So getting into our production notes, H.G. Wells lived from 1866 to 1946. We talked about him in British Invaders 120 and 121 when we talked about The First Men in the Moon, which was also based on one of his novels. He was one of the giants of science fiction literature altogether, really. Not just the British sources, but he wrote many classics, including The Invisible Man, War of the Worlds, First Men in the Moon, The Island of Dr. Moreau, and others. And he's definitely considered one of the fathers of science fiction, and very much a lot of what has been defined as science fiction after these books were written were based on the things that he set up in those various books.
Okay, and then we have this particular work, The Invisible Man. And interestingly, I didn't really know this, but I suppose not uncommonly for Victorian fiction, it was originally published in a serialized form in a magazine called Pearson's Weekly when it came out in 1897, which is interesting, I suppose, because here we have the BBC producing a classic serial from it. The novel itself was published very shortly after the magazine publication, so later the same year. And it's quite a short novel, Brian. It's only 149 pages, quite a quick read.
Yes, most of H.G. Wells' novels, or certainly many of the classics, were quite short. including this and The Time Machine and others.
Yep.
There have been many adaptations of The Invisible Man for film and television. What may be most notable in that was the 1933 Universal horror film, which starred Claude Rains, who of course became famous for that role. The H.G. Wells Invisible Man ITV TV series from 1958 and 59, which was the one we talked about earlier, it was a very different kind of show. It was more of a lighthearted action-adventure series that used the look and the basic idea of the character, but gave the character a very different personality and used completely different stories. And there have been many other TV and film adaptations over the years.
Absolutely. And as we've said, the BBC had this tradition of adapting classic novels as serials, often running at a Sunday tea time. And interestingly, they had also done some previous works by H.G. Wells, and in particular, they'd done a version of The Time Machine as far back as 1949. Now, obviously, this was not recorded, as things weren't then, and only photos of the production survive. They also did a version of The Shape of Things to Come as a play for television in 1966. And again, as far as I know, no recording of that survives. But if you know differently, do please let us know.
In 1974, the team of Barry Letts as producer and Terrence Dix as script editor left Doctor Who. They had been working on Doctor Who from 1970 through 74 with John Pertwee as the Third Doctor, and they did some very good work there, and they went to take over the Sunday Classic Serials strand at that point. And they had quite a bit of success with adaptations of Great Expectations and Nicholas Nickleby and the Sherlock Holmes story The Hound of the Baskervilles in 1982, starring Tom Baker. And in keeping with a lot of BBC novel adaptations, there was a tendency to be very faithful and respectful to the original source material.
And interesting stuff. Again, when we decided to look at this production of The Invisible Man, I confess I had no idea that Barry Letts and Terrence Dix were there somewhere behind the scenes responsible for it. Because it was Terrence Dix himself who became interested in adapting The Invisible Man for this BBC classic serial slot. And so he got the BBC to approach the Wells estate for the rights. And so this was 1981 they got started in with the idea of producing it.
And part of what took a while was not only did they have to get the rights for the novel, they had to get clearance from Universal Studios, who owned the film rights. And Dix and Letts ended up choosing James Andrew Hall to write the script as an adaptation after his successful run on Secret Army.
Yes, another very popular British show with a sort of good pedigree. And so he comes from that to write the script. He decides to set it in 1897, the year of the novel's publication. He decides to reduce the action from the novel, which takes several months in the book, down to just a single summer month, particularly so that Griffin would appear even stranger, wearing heavy clothes and his cloak and hat when the weather was quite sort of warm. And then to direct, Barry Letts chose a young director called Brian Lighthill, who had been, I think, who'd registered with them in Preston for directing two episodes of Blake 7. Those episodes were Gold and Orbit, which are episodes from Series 4 of Blake 7. So another bit of genre pedigree there as well, Brian.
Yes, and they cast Pip Donaghy as the lead actor to play Griffin. He was best known at the time as a stage actor at the National Theatre. And for the flashback sequences where the character is visible, he had to bleach his hair and wear pink contact lenses because, of course, Griffin, in this adaptation, as in the original novel, is an albino, which is part of the reason that the invisibility process works as well as it does, because there are no pigments to interfere.
And he's quite a distinctive-looking actor who we haven't really seen in a lot of television. I think basically, because he's mainly a stage actor, and he certainly is very intense, which suits the rather unpleasant sort of personality of Griffin in the book, and of course in his adaptation. So it works quite well, and as you say, he does look quite sort of spooky with his bleached hair, pink contact lenses, and pale skin.
Yes, for sure.
Then we've got Jack Purvis from the BBC visual effects department, who's using a combination of physical effects and CSO to represent the invisible man and his actions. CSO was the sort of color separation overlay technique they used then to produce a lot of special effects.
CSO was the BBC's name for chroma key or blue screen. It goes by a few different names, but it is the same effect as chroma key.
Right. And as you say, it helps them produce the actions of the invisible man, particularly in the shots where we see empty sleeves and empty clothes and so on. Although some of those are physical effects as well, I think, Brian.
Yes, I believe so.
And interestingly, the director, Brian Lighthill, actually wanted to shoot it in black and white, but didn't get approval for this from the BBC, who insisted on it being a colour production. So instead, we have this very sort of muted, toned-down colour palette here, which sort of gives it almost, I thought, a sort of sepia-tinted appearance at time, and gives us this sort of period feel, which quite works quite well, Brian.
Yes, it would have been really interesting to see this done as a black-and-white production in the 1980s, but they did use the colour to sort of lean to that muted look, which did, as you say, work quite well. Stephen Deutsch wrote the music and conducted the music for it, and it has a nice atmospheric feel to it.
Yes, some good creepy, spooky music, which we like. And once it's all put together, it's supposed to go out on the classic Sunday tea time slot when these adaptations, the BBC classics, would run. But actually, it turned out this series was too violent for that particular slot. And in particular, the BBC, I suppose, standards department had a problem with one scene when Griffin is chasing a character through the woods with an axe. And they decided this was too frightening for a Sunday tea time. So they moved it to a Tuesday evening at 8 p.m, where it went out in September 1984.
And that was it as a series of 6 weekly episodes.
Yep. So, having talked about the production of it, we'll talk about the availability. So, as ever, here in Region 2, we have a DVD release. Fairly stripped down DVD, just the 6 episodes, and a very brief extract from a BBC review programme, which appropriately enough was entitled Did You See?, which was the name of the programme, but fits in quite well with our theme here, Brian.
It does, yes.
But that's fairly brief. We also do have quite a comprehensive viewing notes booklet, which is written by the TV historian Andrew Pixley, who I think we've come across before writing these quite detailed books that go with some of these DVD releases. And that's very good. But as ever, we would suggest that it does contain spoilers and you might want to read it after you've watched the episodes.
Oh, for sure.
So that DVD release here in the UK, £3.25 currently on Amazon, and is also available to rent on the Love Film site.
Well, that's certainly a good deal on that one. There is no Region 1 release, unfortunately, so you would most likely, here in North America, be looking at importing it from amazon.co.uk.
Okay, that's unfortunate, but at least it's not too expensive. At the moment, there are a few clips from episodes up on YouTube, but not complete episodes. However, as we say, it is very cheap to get hold of here, so you might want to try and track it down before our next episode.
The original novel is widely available in a variety of forms. You can find it as ebooks and in physical books and compilations and all sorts of things. There is also a free podcast reading of it on LibriVox. So it's definitely out there and easy to get a hold of.
Okay. So hopefully we've piqued your interest. Next time, do come back, because we're going to talk a little bit more about the story of the Invisible Man and how, of course, the big reveal that's come in. And we'll talk a little bit about the special effects and some of the responses to this adaptation from the 80s.
Yes, absolutely. There's lots to cover there, and we will talk about some of our feelings, what we liked and what we didn't like as well. So you can reach us at BritishInvaders@gmail.com, and you can find us at BritishInvaders.com. We are part of the Geek Culture Network, so you can find us on thegeekculturenetwork.com. We have a Facebook group, so if you search for British Invaders on Facebook, you will find us that way as well.
Absolutely, and quite a lot of activity going on the Facebook page at the moment. Do jump in and join us and tell us what you thought. And you can also find us now on the Voice of Geeks streaming radio at vognetwork.com. And as ever, we welcome our Vogon listeners and hope you're enjoying the show.
Yes, absolutely. So thank you for listening. And this is Brian from Canada signing off.
Yes, thank you very much. And until next time, this is Eamon in England also signing off.